Okay, we're rolling on the 24th of April.
Yeah, we would have done the April 22nd, but world events made it impossible. But this is symbolic of April 22nd, the great date, the great number, the great date. Notice Bin Laden showed up, I don't know, after many years of absence this weekend.
Yeah, I haven't been tuned in on that level, so I didn't know that.
Well, he's dead, but it was just a hologram of him.
Okay.
Yeah, now he died in the fall, late 2001, he died. So he ain't around, so they're just using his son for his voice likeness.
Uh-huh.
In the tapes. Okay, so this is 2006. This is part one of however long it takes to explain Bob's book.
Right.
The book's called Fatic Communion with Bob Dobbs.
Yeah, and I just thought I'd make a couple observations about the cover of the book.
Good. That's where we got to start.
Yeah, which is appropriately the background color is purple.
Pooh.
And and it has a door, like a door lock. What do you call that? It's like an old door lock, the kind that you could sort of peek through and see into another room like they had in the old days.
Yeah, it's a keyhole.
It's a keyhole, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, not the lock. You put the key in to unlock it.
Right. So it's black, so if I stare into it, I can almost imagine that there's anything inside there. I also, maybe I can imagine if there's some symbology about unlocking it or exactly why that symbol is on the cover of your book.
Well, you don't have to. You can just look at the color black. First off, the color for the purple in some traditions symbolizes emperorhood. Sometimes it symbolizes the world of magic and the occult.
Mm-hmm.
So it's implying the hidden ground. Purple's the hidden ground. Yet it's totally visible to you.
Right.
And you get nice white letters. Now, the keyhole, this can be seen as what do they call them now? A wormhole in UFO mythology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a UFO can travel great distances by going in through a zone that is resonant or rubs up against another part of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's symbolic of this blackness is a symbol of the wormhole, but a more common meaning for it would be the black hole of astrophysics.
Mm-hmm.
Also, black is the color for tactility. Tactility is the interplay of the senses, not a sense in itself, but the interplay of the senses, as McLuhan defines it. And the only, since you couldn't see, it's not a visual sense, it's the interplay, not a sense. So to give it any characteristics is not tactility. But you give it for the eye, you give it the color of black, which is a non-color,
mm-hmm.
to represent the absence of color. And the after image of color, black is the appropriate symbol for the after image. And so that's why the symbol for tactility is the color black. So this is a tactile image. Tactile is resonance, light through, light on, all the characteristics. And another thing is that McLuhan really developed this concept of tactility as the interplay of senses and not a sense, so he had to come up with symbols. And so he said the square, the empty square, is a symbol for the tactile. So what you have is this book is not a square, but it's close to a square. So it's not totally McLuhan-esque, so he's got the black and the square resonating. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the book could be made into square.
Sure.
The company made it this way, so...
I wonder if this book... I'd have to get out my ruler. I don't know if it has the relationship of the...
The pie.
Yeah, the gold...
The golden section.
The golden section, yeah.
Okay, well, let me just say, the golden section McLuhan defined as the great Western eye version of the interplay of tensions or tactility.
Oh. Well, that would
look on page 109.
That makes sense for it to be the shape of the book.
Right. And look up page 107 of the paperback version of McLuhan Hot and Cool, where he discusses the importance of the resonant interval in the Zen Eastern Orient, you know, the Orient or the Eastern metaphysics, and the Golden Section in the Western metaphysics, as both attempts through cultural bias to talk about the symmetry of tensions, the ratio of symmetries among tensions.
Interesting.
Now the what we're looking at here is a book, which is an extension of the eye. So we're trying to show here the tactile eye. Very hard to do. I mean, the popular image in the medium is massage is the ear over the eye.
Right.
It was Duchamp's friend Man Ray who made that photograph. Though I'm not sure, it might have been someone else. The ear over the eye is a way of showing acoustic space. But let's put have the hand over the eye, hand being the symbol of tactility, and that would be the tactile eye. So, or you would add to the ear over the eye, the hand, to make it odile tactile eye.
Mm-hmm.
So that's played here on the cover, right? You're trying to show the nothingness, the invisible, non-visual space of the black of the keyhole.
Right.
But then you have the white edge of the keyhole to show depth and perspective, and it's also the flipping back and forth of the visual pun.
That's right.
Yeah, what do you call those
black
things?
Against white, the black text against the white page, the visual space.
Right, but also if you look at the key, you're looking up or you're looking down as the white outline of the key flips back and forth. You're looking up to the roof.
Right.
Or you're looking down into a hole.
Uh-huh.
What do you call those things? Not visual puns, but Escher. Escher, I think it was Escher.
Mm-hmm.
Made those kind of paintings. But
right.
There was another, there may be a technical term for, Trompe l'œil, the trick of the eye.
Mm-hmm.
The oscillating back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So you got Trompe l'œil here on the cover, and the Trompe l'œil is talked about by Baudrillard and later by Croker as the image of the anamorphic. And the anamorphic is not the fractile. The fractile is the micro in relation to the macro.
Mm-hmm.
Micro, macro, the hologram, the popularization of the fractile image.
Mm-hmm.
But the scattering of that fractile symmetry between the micro and the macro, which is the Android mean conditions we live in, leads to total distortion. And that's it's called the anamorphic, which was an art form, a painterly style 400 years ago. Yeah, 400. Just after the Renaissance, before the Baroque,
mm-hmm.
which would sort of like surrealism, sort of juxtapose odd relationships to the eye on the painting to counter the symmetry of Renaissance perspective.
Mm.
So it actually showed optical distortion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's and now you have what else is happening there.
Well, I just wanted to comment on the black. I'm wondering if it would be even more accurate since tactility implies resonance and maybe even electricity in a way. You know, the Tibetans, they talk about the clear light of the void. It's a radiant darkness. It's actually not a void, an empty darkness. It's actually a radiant darkness, which is full of...
Well, that's the resonant interview I was citing on page 107 of McLuhan Hot and Cool. It's the same awareness. Dark and light and neither, but pulsating and alive.
Mm-hmm.
So the white light of yoga or Tibetan Buddhism or whatever religions mention that is the symbol for electric tactility
mm-hmm. yeah.
of the central nervous system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the oscillating back and forth, it's the bright darkness. It's paradox. What for the literate mind is separate dualities are interpenetrated in pre-book awareness or pre-literate awareness
mm-hmm.
or post-literate awareness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
The name Bosch, isn't there an artist named Bosch that pre-Renaissance or Renaissance, he painted really sort of grotesque paintings where there was not a lot of symmetry in the...
Well, that was Hieronymus Bosch.
Hieronymus Bosch, yeah. Would he be an example of the anamorphic?
No, not really, because they show people, but they'd be in odd situations. They'd be inside bubbles, different juxtapositions of people. It still was people. Think of surrealism as more like the anamorphic, you know, totally bizarre juxtapositions. Maybe slightly. It definitely, McLuhan, you know, includes a picture of Bosch's famous painting in the medium, in the War and Peace in the Global Village.
Mm-hmm.
And Bosch, it represents, he defined that as the clash of sensibilities going out of the medieval, largely oral culture into the new print-induced eye culture, and the conflict and stress on collective and personal psyches led to all kinds of odd human juxtapositions, which are painted by Bosch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, that was probably unconscious on Bosch's part, I don't think. Do you think he understood the transition going on in terms of media, or he was just he just had a weird sensibility that seemed to match what was going on?
I don't know. I haven't read much about him, though some people suspect that he was taking psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
There's that explanation. He didn't understand macro level. People couldn't have seen that. They didn't have access to the environments, macro environments that we have to see these macro changes. But he either, by coincidence, if he was taking drugs, he just did it, and it was preserved as an odd thing, and then only becomes resonant in our time. You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't know his personal motivations in doing it. But even then, the artist can be pretty tuned in, and it was what he wanted to paint. He may not have understood why he felt the need to do that, but he knew he had the pressure, the necessity to paint it that way. So he was responding to something as an antenna. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I'd have to look into what scholars say about him, what they know about him now.
Mm-hmm.
That you bring up the electric, there's more to this cover.
Yeah, well, there's a string or a wire coming out of the keyhole.
Yes.
And it moves off to the left side of the book, and then you have to turn the book over, and then you see that it's connected to the handset of a telephone with the mouthpiece and the earpiece.
Yeah, the old kind of telephone.
Yeah.
Pre-digital.
Right.
So what you have here is there's lots of eye stuff going on here. The keyhole, you look through something with your eye. A wire is a connecting aspect, which is a characteristic of acoustic space. I mean, a visual space. And then the rigid white outline of the keyhole creates a little depth, so that's eye-oriented. But that's just the first surface level. Then you look at it more closely, and you see that it's that black can symbolize tactility, and the image is oscillating back and forth, the trompe-l'oeil of the key and the white rim. And then the wire is white and then black, but then it goes to an electric instrument, a telephone.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side. And so the bottom, the telephone, is a keyhole.
Oh.
It's an acoustic keyhole. You get access. You go through the hole. You are sent, and your receiver is sent to you. The interpenetration of spaces is symbolized by the telephone. So you're looking at the eye on the cover,
mm-hmm.
surface eye effect, but then you turn it over and there's an electric ground. Especially with the title, Hand Signals for the Blind.
Question mark. It's a question.
Right. And for the blind would be people inside acoustic space, and I'm attempting to visualize that acoustic tactile space.
Mm.
So the book is saying, these are things for you to see. For the blind person, the blindness induced by the electric non-visual space.
Right.
Now, hand signals, though, it's not something to see.
Well, you're trying to create an image of visual space for the retribalized electronic man.
Right. Exactly. And so I have to use, I don't say signals for the blind or letters or signs for the blind. I say hand signals to indicate the gesture and the tactile character of the hand and the fact the hand is something, if you close your eyes, you can't see hand signals. So how could this be hand signals for blind people? Unless you feel the hand signals. Unless the hand signals rub up against you and massage you.
Mm-hmm.
A masseuse can give you hand signals.
Mm-hmm.
So So there's the mixed media, mixed sensory symbolism there in the title. So the back and the front of the book resonate back and forth, like the keyhole, eye, ear, but pointing to the tactility. And the tactility is indicated by the word hand signals rather than just signs or signals. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So it has the peeping through aspect, and which brings in the idea of the eye. I don't know, is the idea of locking and unlocking something part of the...
Yes, the keys to, remember the last line of Finnegan's Wake. The keys to given.
Mm-hmm.
So the key, the shape of the key, if you have a lock, you need the key.
Right.
So this book or this image gives you the shape of the key. So you make a key in the shape of this of the lock here. No, you make a key in the shape of the keyhole here. You have the keys to what I'm trying to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Opens up the secret society. Now, let me just say, just hold it a second, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let me just get something. In reference to the meaning of the keyhole and the meaning of the keyness itself, from page 26 on The Interior Landscape, McLuhan's essay on Joyce, James Joyce, he says, Joyce made his poem in the shape of the key which unlocks it.
Mm.
So you look at the keys to given is the last line of Finnegan's Wake. The keys to, period, given, exclamation mark.
Uh-huh.
We've given you the keys.
Yeah.
But what shape is the key in? If you understand this book, or you understand there's a shape being provided by the book, and it gives you the shape of the key, then you know how to make a key and unlock the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to, and, you know, Finnegan's Wake ends a process that goes from, and within Western poetry, from Pope's work and the Dunciad up to Finnegan's Wake. Pope enunciates the darkness coming due to a surfeit or overdoing of literacy, and then Joyce says, wait, we're out of the nightmare of the dullness of literacy. We're awaking from it in the electric age due to electric media. So that...
The dullness of literacy?
Yeah, the dullness of overuse of books.
Hmm.
That's the theme in Gutenberg Galaxy. The last section.
Well, it became at the height of visual space. Well, I guess Marshall probably considered that to be manuscript culture.
No. The visual space is.
In other words, I think he probably thought that it became overused during Gutenberg when books became so. So they became distributed everywhere so much so that they began to lose their significance or something.
So they became dull. Dullness is D-U-L-N-E-S-S. We would have two L's.
Yeah.
But dullness is the way Pope...
Well, I'm just saying that, like, during manuscript... I know Marshall was a fan of Renaissance and the illuminated manuscripts. And
not a fan. Not a fan of anything.
Oh, okay.
He pointed out that...
I think he did like the aesthetic sensory ratio balance of, you know, these of the manuscript. There was that element of both hemispheres, because in order to read a book when it's been written by a scribe, you have to be able to parse the letters out of the handwriting of the scribe. It has a certain artistic quality to it that has to be interpreted by the eye. So you have to both look at it and read it. Whereas when you get to text, you read it. You don't notice you don't look at it at all anymore.
There's a little bit of accuracy in what you're saying. Definitely, he thought the medieval culture was more balanced because it had eye and ear, because people read out loud. Once you have literacy, you read in the printed book phase, Gutenberg phase, you read silently, so you miss the acoustic dimensions. The eye, the ear is numbed down.
Mm-hmm.
This is the dullness. It's too much eye, not enough of the other senses
mm-hmm.
that Pope is talking about. But the medieval culture, its interplay of senses was more balanced, and the visual extreme excess of the post-Gutenberg era led into a favor of dialectics and Newtonian science, which Blake and Pope critiqued as being too eye-oriented and missing the other multi-sensuousness that poetry and the fine arts provided.
Mm-hmm.
That was the beginning of the split between science and the humanities, or science and the arts. So, but the balance, there was an ecology in our time way better than the medieval situation, because we had all the senses extended in a complex ecology by the middle of the 50s and 60s, especially under television. So it was similar to medieval culture, similar balance, but totally new, and medieval concepts, Chinese concepts. Chinese was slightly, he would say, similar to the medieval sensibility. Those sensibilities were not useful in handling the present.
Mm-hmm.
A new kind of sensibility. So, okay, we went off on, why did we get off on that? Because I was telling you about the key, and you brought up the manuscript. Why did you bring that up? What was...
Well, there's another...
No, we didn't finish. Why are we talking about the midi... You brought up... Oh, I was saying the Pope and the Dullness. I didn't finish it. So,
Dullness, yeah.
Yeah. So the so Pope...
Pope Dunciad, or...
Beg your pardon?
Who? Pope who?
Alexander Pope, the poet, the English poet, wrote the Dunciad. That was his last masterwork.
Oh, okay.
But here's the sentence. I read you the statement about Joyce and the key. But the sentence before it is, Pope, Alexander Pope wrote, quote, a key to the lock. That was a afterword about the poem. The Rape of the Lock is the famous poem. So Pope wrote a key to the Rape of the Lock by way of an elaborate exegesis of the symbolic senses of his poem. Now, since one of the characters in Pope's writings is the musical fowl Belinda, that is used in a great deal in the Fitting His Wake. So, McLuhan says, and the central feature of the Fitting His Wake, or of Fitting His Wake, is the exegesis of a letter dug up by the musical fowl Belinda. Belinda is the, if I recall, is the woman whose lock is lost, or is the lock that's discussed in the poem, The Rape of the Lock. So it's a musical file, Belinda. Then McLuhan says, Pope wrote a key to the lock by way of an elaborate exegesis of the symbolic senses of his poem. So the key to the lock. Then he says, Joyce made his poem in the shape of the key, which unlocks it. So Pope is talking about the lock, and Joyce is presenting the key. So I wanted to finish that thought.
Yeah.
So back to the cover here.
Right.
We're talking about going through interpenetration when you're on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Did we finish that thought?
Yeah.
Okay, now what else is on the back page?
Hand signals for the blind is the statement, and then there's the... a little icon down at the bottom, which is underlined by the publisher Perfect Pitch, and the icon looks like some kind of a pizza or a platter divided up into pie sections or something.
Right, and with two P's.
With two P's, yeah, and they're mirror images.
Mirror images. Now, if you open the book to the first page, page one, you will see a completer image of that icon.
Oh, yeah.
You'll see the little V underneath Perfect Pitch.
Right.
So the V can be referenced 22, 22nd letter in the alphabet, which is also the 22, the resonance of that with the cabal and the master number.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect Pitch, I'm thinking of McLuhan saying that the artist of our time, the real artist, the serious artist, the correct artist, the most valuable artist, has perfect pitch.
Yeah.
The artist resonates with the time and mirrors it and provides an anti-environment to it.
Mm.
So we called this book Thought of Communion with Bob Dawes, published by Perfect Pitch Editions. And the address was Carolyn's old office, where there was a sign out front, Doctors for Bob, B, capital B, dot, capital O dot, capital B dot, which, of course, referred to me, but if when pressured, if some authority came in and didn't like it, want to know what Bob stood for, she'd say, building organic bodies.
Okay.
Yeah. And Jerry Pialka has a picture of the old office with the sign in front. I mean, I have it, but if you're ever near Jerry, he can show it to you.
I've seen it.
Okay, and it's, the address is 598 St. Clair. 59 is 14 and 8 is 22.
Okay.
598 St. Clair Avenue West. Now, perfect pitch, the symbol is a combination of the vortices symbol that Wyndham Lewis came up with in 1914 for their manifesto called Blast. And you see a line goes up between the two P's, which are mirroring each other. In the Blast manifesto, it's a V and the line going up upside down, the opposite of what I have here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the circle is visual space, and then the divisions are can be the fragmentation of visual space that the eye enhances.
Now I thought visual space was represented by the pyramid or the triangle.
Yeah, that's one version of visual space. Most of the symbols that we use in iconography are visual space, except for the infinity sign, the Mobius strip. But, you know, the circle, the square, they're all I, the simple, you know, the triangle, the square, the circle, the cone, they're all I symbols.
Mm-hmm.
But within the I world, the circle is visual space and the square is tactility.
Okay.
So, but you've got the circle here and the point going through it,
right.
The rod going up the middle, which slices the two P's. And the P's, P is the 16th letter, 1 and 6 is 7, so you got two P's, that's 7, 7 is 14. But also, P being the 16th letter and having two P's is 32, so therefore you get the 32 feet per second, right?
Mm-hmm.
The falling rate of acceleration,
right.
And but it's going up and down in this situation. So we get a multi-directional thing here.
Mm.
And P is 16, and that's 2/8. So there you get the 8, which is the symbol of the Dobbs quadrant on the chart.
Okay.
And the 8 could intertwine.
The 8 on its side.
Beg your pardon?
The 8 on its side.
Right. And then the two P's, if each is an 8, 2/8, then they become 4/8, and then you get a tetrad, and they intertwine.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot you can do with the symbol.
Interesting.
And so the PP on the back, Ed Walker, who did the design, the actual work, for some reason he couldn't get the V. I don't know why the V isn't there. I may have told him to drop it, but I don't think I did. I just think it wasn't able to come through strong enough, or he forgot to. So that may be a mistake.
Okay.
But it's cool to have a mistake because you look at it there, and then if you look inside, you should notice a difference. So it's good to have a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there might have been some discussion between me and him about whether to put the V on the outer cover. I can't remember, but we can rationalize it either way.
Mm-hmm. A lot of alchemy in that little symbol.
Yeah. Alchemy is the tradition of transformation and metamorphosis. You know, the term that led into chemistry,
mm-hmm.
and that is generally a Western tradition. I mean, it's a term for the Western world, right?
Mm-hmm.
There were other. I don't know what other cultures in the East had. Or South had in terms of alchemy. I don't know if they would have the same dynamic of working with matter that visual space cultures get into,
right?
Because visual space begins to contain matter.
Yeah.
It's actually intuition that we're going into a leaden process. We're contained. We need to get out of the container.
Mm-hmm.
So alchemy probably is a cure to the effects of visual space, caused by visual space. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anything more on the book?
Once we just get open up to the...
So there's a lot of claims made by this book, right?
Implied. Yeah, well, actually, you claimed that you're representing... help me along here. You're taking visual space and making it visible to as something you're making it visible as an image. Is that what you were saying?
You mean a little while ago?
Yeah.
I mean, I was visualizing tactility.
Visualizing tactility, exactly. And but of course, Joyce did that before you. So are you trying to accomplish something different from Joyce, or are you, the same thing in another form?
Well, we're in a different time, but definitely Joyce is a prefiguring of our time. And Finnegan's Wake is very important. And remember, this book is partly an elaboration of the chart, or the chart is a simplification of the book.
Right.
And the chart, Tiny Note Chart and Bob Dobbs' former chart, is based on Finnegan's Wake, or has a deep reference to Finnegan's Wake.
Right.
Like across the top of the Dobbs' former chart, you have the five family members of Finnegan's Wake. So definitely Joyce is a precursor here. But it is not limited to Finnegan's Wake. But yes, definitely he was the one who made a masterpiece that contained tactility within the visual medium. And that's why he said he squared the wheel, which nobody could do, squared the circle. Nobody had ever been able to do that. He figured out how to take these totally, you know, antithesis property, antithetic properties of eye and the hand and bring them together in a book. But he resolved it because I will show the other modalities that visual space suppresses that make the eye see it through its own medium, the book. Therefore, I'm going to have all the other senses, and that's like Finnegan's Awake. I'm making a book totally, he's saying, I'm making a book totally aware of its services and disservices, including all the others. Here comes everybody. That could be the eye speaking about the other senses, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's making the whole panoply and the extensions of those senses included within the book, but in the end, it is a book. But even that, it's not just a, say, Gutenberg book where you read silently. It's designed to be read out loud, too.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got it covered completely. So it's the most comprehensive book ever made.
So it's a book attempting to mirror television?
Yes. Well, to counter television, include the effects, point out the advantages of television.
It subsumes, would you say it subsumes television?
To the degree one thinks the eye has to retrieve the book, which will be swamped and made obsolete by television. So you got to make, if you believe in the agenda of preserving the eye, like Wyndham Lewis did, and Wyndham Lewis is a major character in Finnegan's Wake, Joyce takes the eye and brings it back, and provides a semi-anti-environment to the effect of television. When you have Finnegan's Wake, you don't need to watch television, because television is like the theosophical Akashic records, all content of human history there available, and it's even become more obvious as we get into the digital era, got all information, but Joyce wanted to put all information in a little portable book.
Yeah.
So the effects of television, he said, here's a cheaper way to have television. And to be conscious of the effect of television. So subsume it, make an anti-environment to it. An amazing achievement.
Mm-hmm.
When you understand all these points.
It seemed like one of his goals, like for instance in the mystical Kabbalah, they say that when you're looking at, like for instance, the first line of the Torah, that the whole Torah is contained within the first letter. But if you can't parse it out, then it's all contained in the first word. And if you can't parse it out of that, then it's all contained in the first phrase and sentence and paragraph and so on. And seems to me I heard that Finnegan's Wake, the whole thing's really contained in the first few pages. Is that true?
Well, it's contained in the fact that it has no content.
Well,
remember, tactility is not a sense. It has no content.
Yeah.
The Christian believes that this world is a something that came out of nothing.
Yeah.
Pagan philosophy, science doesn't believe that. They think there has to be something that this something came out of. The Christian doesn't believe that. So, if television is and tactility for McCullough is a symbol of nothingness, because it's an interplay of senses but not a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Think of television, if it's the full extension of tactility, then TV is a nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
An extending of the tactility, which is nothing. So something out of nothing. So what did you say to make me, you said something about...
Yeah, it's the whole content of the book.
So the nothing is the first content.
Mm-hmm.
The no thing is
right.
The first content. All right? Or it is the I trying to swallow it. When looking up a sentence here, you brought up the Kabbalah. McLuhan says that to get a... here it is, page 33 of his essay on Joyce, Trivial and Quadrivial. To this knowledge, Joyce added the Thomistic insights into the relation... Oh, sorry. Joyce's insistence on the, quote, absent-minded, unquote, or absid-minded, A-B-C-D-E, absid-minded, nature of his drama, but he spells it A-B-C-E-D rather than A-B-C-D-E. Joyce's insistence on the absent-minded nature of his drama can be illustrated from his attitude to the alphabet's rope. He was familiar with the entire range of modern archaeological and anthropological study of pre-alphabetic syllabaries and hieroglyphics, including the traditional Kabbalistic lore. So there's the Kabbalistic.
Yeah.
To this knowledge, he added the Thomistic insight into the relation of these things with mental operations. I think he says somewhere else, you need to have an awareness of the Kabbalah to get around in the wake. I'm going to try to find that right now. But, yes, once you have nothing, then you begin what comes next, the sound. So the first thing that Joyce begins with is a sound. That's the thunder. Okay?
Well, I think from the Kabbalistic perspective, the first thing maybe the breath. I don't know, and then the sound. I'm not sure.
And the breath is an interesting multisensual phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anyway, so the pre-literate cultures thought the spirit was in the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And if the spirit is all quite comprehensive, then the breath must have been perceived as comprehensive, and comprehensiveness is tactility in a way. So you're saying that the wake begins with a letter. Yes, it begins with sound or a gesture. Then when you begin to write it, to write the wake, it begins with one letter. And then more than one letter. Then you get words, then you get sentences, then you get ideograms, and then you get alphabets. So you're saying... So that means that each letter has great significance.
Mm-hmm.
Alchemical, poetic, and a symbolist, a metaphor that comes out of the symbolist doctrine in Paris of the 19th century of the correspondences, that each letter was symbolic of a color or a music or a plant.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan goes into this in his essay on Joyce in the book I'm quoting from.
Right.
So yes, each letter, you begin with one letter. But that's after the gesture and before that the silence.
Yeah.
And before that the nothing.
Yeah. Now I'm not a expert, I'm not real knowledgeable on this subject, but I've always been a little bugged by the notion that with the Arabic, the Hebrew, and the Greek, these alphabets, the especially the Hebrew, I'm most familiar with that. Each letter, it actually is tactile in a sense because it has associated with it a sound, an image, and a frame of reference which gives it a kind of a shape and a form and a meaning. And so, I imagine you put those letters together, you get something quite musical and something that really could illuminate speech such that, if you know the right sequence of mantrams, like they say in Kabbalah, you can move mountains, just by speaking. But then with the phonetic alphabet, each letter just seems so empty and devoid of all of that richness. And I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems to me as though we're missing out on all the action because we use the phonetic alphabet.
Okay, the Greek phonetic alphabet comes out of the Hebrew. Hebrew alphabet, which came out of the Phoenician alphabet, and you track it back to Sumerians in 3000 BC when writing began, at least in the West, or European West. Nothing is more sensual than speech and the interplay of all the senses. But when we start moving into the eye, you get writing, and then you get the more refined writing of the Phoenicians, who took their accounting books and had to, since they were sea traders and moved around and did a lot of business, they had to have a way of keeping the records. So they made a streamlined, you could say, business-like alphabet for practical bookkeeping.
Right.
And that was the beginning of streamlining the multisensual characteristics of ideogrammic and hieroglyphic writing of the Sumerians and Egyptians, which had more tactility or more multisensuousness in it.
Right. And that's where
let's get to the emptiness. So when the Greeks abstract the vowels from the consonants,
uh-huh,
and you can read all this in detail in McLuhan and Robert Logan's book, The Alphabet, the Mother Invention, that's a good book to give you the stages. And now, doesn't the Kabbalah have 22 letters, the Hebrew alphabet?
Yeah, plus five final letters, which gives it 27.
Right. So the meaning of 22 on my chart is it's more resonant. It's I, more resonant I. But, so when the phonetic alphabet abstracted the vowel from the consonant, you had for the first time an abstract, empty void.
Mm.
And it was Augustine who took that effect of this abstract void, called it a soul, and resolved the eternal contradictions and paradoxes of Greek tribal life, Greek barbarian life, or just pagan life. They never could resolve the paradoxes of existence. Now, ancient tribes, way pre-letter, there was no such thing as a paradox or contradiction. They didn't have a context, a square, to find out a problem. But once you start getting into writing, you get these philosophical problems within the written effect that comes into Greek culture. And they don't resolve it from Plato down to Christ, but Augustine came in and resolved it by creating the third term, which was this abstract space, and that was the individual soul. And that was a place outside of the seeming contradictions and paradoxes that semi-literate tribal life caused,
mm-hmm,
but could not resolve.
Mm-hmm.
So the service of this abstract emptiness of the phonetic alphabet was Christianity. It allowed people to develop their idea of a something disconnected from the pulsating buzz and chaos and tyranny of tribal life, of acoustic life. Now, that's why I would say the Christians became hypnotized about the afterlife. They sacralized this space, that the buzz of sensory existence was not as important as this visual void, which they called life after death or heaven, right?
Mm, yeah.
And why were the Christians so devoted, from our perspective, to the afterlife? Well, it was an effect of the phonetic alphabet.
Yeah. Well, nature abhors a vacuum.
A vacuum.
And if you go into a sensory deprivation tank, the brain will just start projecting images because the mind can't really handle being blank. So
let's hold that. No, the mind takes information in, takes data in, alters it, and then projects that back out on the earth, on the world. So there's an interplay between what is given to the senses and how you and your senses alter it.
Yeah.
That process goes on when you're inside the tank. You start making, because you become aware of the making part of your cognition, the half of it, because there's no external stimulus to numb down the making part of your cognition.
Right.
You get it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now back to the emptiness. So this emptiness of visual space was a novelty. This was totally new. And this explains why celibacy, even though that's up and down in the church history, but the idea that the priest was not in this world, of this world but not of it, in this world but not of it, right?
That's would that be a more of a Gnostic spin?
The Gnosticism, the Gnostic heresy, is these guys under the impact of visual space, but yearning for the acoustic sensual.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you can be, you're stuck in visual space, you're schizoid, you're split. And I don't mean that as derogatory. You're split, but you can unify it in the abstract space. So the service is you unify, but it has a inherent split and detachment from existence. So in that situation, you can go back to the sensuality, therefore the Eleusinian mysteries, or you can go into total removal of the sensory life. So you have a monk tradition, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the monastery tradition. Or you can say this world is, you can romanticize the abstract void and say that is reality and this world is fallen. That's one part of the Gnosticism. There are different kinds of Gnosticism, but one of them is this world is a battle of light and dark. Get out of this situation and leave. You know what I mean?
Right.
Escape from this dimension. So there are all variations and responses, personal psychological responses, to the dilemma the visual space created.
Yeah. Went to the extreme where they believed, some Gnostics believe that actually this whole creation was a sub-creation by some kind of a demon and was not really connected to God. And as long, unless you could actually get outside, you know, of your of this world, of your body, you couldn't be united with God.
Right. The Gnostic was a heresy